7, 8, 9, 10.
You have a strength. Now tell me about you.
Well, I'm a history professor at Georgia Tech, and I started doing this about 2 years ago. It's a study of race relations in 20th century Atlanta. And I'm really trying to look at the impact of racism and race relations on the development of the city, on its institutions, on its physical development. So I've been interviewing various people who are active during that time who have something to say. So let me get into some of my questions. First of all, I was curious how effective your organization was in changing segregationist policies. This is a very general question, of course.
I think at that time, the Council on Human Relations, I would say that we did nothing as far as making a change.
Mm-hmm.
I think what we did was to back up and bolster the people that were out on the front line. For instance, I never, as a director, even felt that I should say to SNCC, or to LC or to SCLC or anybody else, this is the way something might be done, we might make change faster.
Mm-hmm.
Something like that. I can't imagine doing it, but the part we played was, what can we do to help you?
Mm-hmm.
You're great. And then they would tell us what they could do. And with me, there were lots of times there was something that a white person, that they needed a white person.
So you had pretty good coordination with the black organization.
Oh, yes, yes. Some more than others. Now, in Atlanta itself, I never worked very much. I worked early in Atlanta, but the Georgia Council, there were two councils. There was an Atlanta Council and a Georgia Council. And the Georgia Council and the Atlanta Council had a director, and they worked in Atlanta, see.
Mm-hmm.
And you couldn't do it, you couldn't even begin to do it all anyway. I mean, when I was there, so what I did outside of Atlanta, and that didn't mean that I didn't participate in a lot of different things in Atlanta too, but it meant that I didn't know, for instance, the SNCC people in Atlanta, I didn't know them like I knew the SNCC people in Albany.
I always got the impression that Atlanta was neglected in a lot of ways, that all the protests were taking place elsewhere, and Atlanta was sort of almost considered an oasis by a lot of the civil rights organizations.
Well, a lot went on here because of the student movement here.
Right, right.
And I think that was about the biggest thing. The Council on Human Relations during that time was headed up by. I guess most of that time, most of the sections, it was headed up by Eliza Pastor.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know exactly what part they did play, actually, because you were so busy doing what you had to do.
Right.
But the kinds of things we did were to try to be a go-between always.
Mm-hmm. Go-between
the whites and the blacks.
Yeah.
And for instance, in a place like Albany, we tried and did get set up an interracial committee that would help to bring in some recommendations for a solution of the immediate problem, and things like that that we could do where we could go on both sides of the street, and I could. I could go on the white side, truthfully, I could go on the black side easier than I could go on the white side, because by the time you went on the black side twice, a lot of doors on the white side.
Mm, sure.
For sure. Mm. In fact, I remember going up to a man who later ran for mayor in Albany, and I had been friends with him and his wife when they lived here, and I went to see them, and they came to the door and told me, no, they wouldn't invite me in, and not come back again. People felt like keenly about the race issue. But nevertheless, we did, and we thought we kept figuring different ways, trying everything under the sun to set up communications between blacks and whites. We set up church prayer groups. We set up businessmen. The businessmen said, because they were upset about business being messed up. So they say, all right, we'll meet with some of the black leaders, but don't bring a whole bunch in here. And if there's say five of us, we'll meet with five of them. I said, okay, I'll see if five want to meet with you. And I'd go, damn, just if five of you want to go. They said they'll meet with five.
So just little steps.
And little things like that. See, businessmen, churches, preachers got preachers together. Mm-hmm. And then we organized a council.
Did you have much relationship at all with the state government? Were people willing
yes.
to talk to you there?
Yes. I had met Sanders before he was governor in some race problems in Augusta.
Mm-hmm.
There's a white guy that went down into the black area of the city with a mask on, with a black stocking on his head, and shot up and killed. I forget who got killed, whether it's white got killed. Anyway, there was some, and this caused a big riot. Pupil and Sanders were in Augusta, and I went down to see what I could do in this occasion, and we organized a council and trying to get the two sides together and I knew them there, see, and they respected what I had done by them. Not that it was all that much, but they did, and also it always helps if they just, I think one thing I have built up over a long period of years in the state by organizing
meetings. So you think somebody like Sanders was cooperative then?
Yeah, so when he was governor, I went to see him.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, now look, this is the job I'm doing. And I'm going out over the state, and I may need your help sometime. And he told me, he said, now, I'm not going to help. But what I promise you this is, and he said, I admire what you're trying to do. And he said, when you plow the furrow, I'll help you to hold it.
Okay. So he was there as a support, but behind the scenes, is that it? Yeah.
And I called him.
Yeah.
Not many times. And every time I called him, they helped.
So he was there, I mean, but he was the only governor during the time that was there to help. I suppose everybody else was opposition.
Yeah, I can't remember anybody else over there ever helping with him. But he sent the state patrol into Baker the day they said they were going to kill me.
Mm-hmm.
And I called him. Because the state patrol, I was more afraid of the state. Out in the state,
mm-hmm.
I was terrified out of the state patrol.
They tried to do you harm.
Yeah. And I remember one time in Albany, I couldn't find it. The Holiday Inn wouldn't let me in. And the newspaper men were all staying away, and I wanted. And that's where I usually stayed, and so the only place I could get in was the same hotel where the state patrol was staying, and I was scared to death.
Mm-hmm.
And so I came back, and the newspaper man said, where have you been? And I said, well, I couldn't get in. They said, what do you mean you couldn't get in? I said, they wouldn't let me in. Yeah. And because that's where we always met. And they said, well, we'll see about it. And I said, don't go back down there except to get your things. So that is not safe. and so they called the headquarters, the newspaper man,
mm-hmm.
uh, got me a ring. It ended up with some of them on one side of my ring and some of them on the other side. Paul Sutton was one of them. I always remember. I'm so glad to see him in that.
In that documentary.
Oh, I was able to see him.
Yeah, so he really did back you up then. He was there when you needed him to. Yeah.
He was. But and the FBI was kind of the same way. I mean, you knew you had Washington, because the one thing with it was you didn't know that you had Washington
before. Yeah. I don't think you have to feel dumb about it. There's a lot of people who have that problem, actually.
So I just believe if somebody wants me to come somewhere at night, that's
right. That's right. I was curious about a King statement that he made in 1963. He said that in the absence of legal, political, economic, and moral pressure, not even a city as enlightened as Atlanta is likely to grant the Negro his constitutional rights. Two things there. How much pressure was really needed to bring about some change in Atlanta and Georgia in general?
Well, it depended a lot on the leadership in the town. In some places, the leadership was dyed-in-the-wool segregationists. And they would rather go broke. I remember a banker in there. He would rather go broke and his bank fail than to give in on segregation. He was that adamant. Now, the business leaders in Savannah were much more progressive. And they did not want, all the leaders were. The man that was head of the Historical Society didn't want the city burned. And what a lot of ruffians, they weren't really attached to any of the best organized groups, but just ruffians were setting fire. I mean it. Setting fire and turning false alarms and turning alarms. And it was, tell you what, it was touch and go what that city was going to burn. And they gave in.
How about here?
In Atlanta, that's what I can't tell you. Now, they did have some leadership here that was good, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the businessmen here would have any time given in before they would have. I think they'd do anything to save their dollars. And it wasn't, but it would take something else. Another thing about it just depended on how deeply they were committed to segregation.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them were. In Albany, the businessmen were as bad.
So what do you think the difference is? Just how committed they were to business and...
And how committed they were to segregation.
And to the image of the city.
Uh-huh.
I mean, the lessons of Little Rock must have been clear
in
Birmingham in terms of what...
Well, of course, when did Birmingham come? What year?
63, I guess it was.
Yeah, see, Albany was about 61.
Yeah, but Little Rock was clear to everybody by that time.
Yeah, that's right. Well, Talmadge saw the handwriting on the wall because Talmadge in 53, they passed the legislature passed private school for them.
Mm-hmm.
The legislature did. Now, of course, it was voted. It wasn't voted on by the public for 54, but Talmadge got that through because he saw the schools were going to be desegregated. So a lot of the people saw it coming.
Mm-hmm.
And so they changed they changed the Constitution so that Georgia could support private schools.
That was the beginning of the resistance down here, we did.
And that was the beginning of the big resistance because we fought that, see? And it came right on the heels of the Cannon Amendment, which was also turned into a segregation
problem. Right. I was just kind of curious to see how enlightened leaders, for example, in Atlanta were. I always got this image that there was a tradition of compromise and communication between the black and white communities.
It wasn't all that good. And let me tell you what, I literally loathed that pretty chief of police.
Jenkins?
Yeah.
Oh, what was the problem with him?
Well, I remember one, he looked so pretty. I remember one is, there'd been a killer. Police had killed, of course this happened all the time, then, honestly, that's awful feeling, isn't it, to think that it happened so much more now than it did then, but it does. I think it was at Perry Hunter, I believe, it was in one of the projects, the police killed a black man and injured a child. And we were taking care of the child. The child was in bed and was going to be sent home and wasn't going to ever be well.
Mm-hmm.
And we were raising some money and things to take care of the child. And I can't remember what year this was. And this must have been before. Maybe this was in the late 50s. I can't remember that.
Mm-hmm.
We had, at that time, there was a lot of unrest out there, and we had some people out there, and we had somebody that saw this happen. We drew a diagram of where the police were standing, where the people were that were shot. And we went to Jenkins, and we said, now what are you going to do about this? You're going to let those policemen keep on shooting like that? And in one instance, some of us had been out there, and there had been a lot of shots that day. We thought they'd been blanks, so we went to see him, and he said, yeah, that's right. Wasn't any press there. Tomorrow always takes place. He said, yeah, this is what happened, but you don't think I'm going to say it is. And said, it doesn't matter what you say, they're not going to believe you. Go down and let the papers and tell them, he said.
So he didn't care about the police brutality issue?
No. He said, go tell your story to the paper, and I'll tell my story to the paper, and we'll see who gets printed. And we did, and he was right. And so then, in the last that day, he said, Miss Paul, you ought to be more careful about what you do. Oh, so then he told us that they always shot the kid.
Mm-hmm.
All of us went white. That day, I tell you. Because we'd been out there when there'd been the shooting going on. And he said, we want to also tell you that we shoot to kill.
Whites as well as blacks, or just blacks?
And we said, well, maybe it's time for us to go. We stood up, and he said, Miss Polly, I'd like to tell you, you better be more careful about what you do. And I said, well, Chief, do you mean for me to take that as a threat? He said, take it any way you want.
He was no moderate then, huh?
That was my personal experience.
Yeah.
Let me tell you, you don't forget things like that. If somebody threatens to kill you, you don't exactly, and him being the chief police,
of course.
You don't exactly forget it at the moment.
You don't see him as being any...
any friendly. You don't think he's going to protect you if the Ku Klux is out there with a gun.
Well, he was. I mean, he was there. I mean, the police have gotten very good press.
That's right. Beautiful press, just like Pritchett did down there in Albany.
Yeah. You don't think it was a true?
No. Now, they were smart and they were smooth.
Yeah.
Both of them.
In what way?
They handled it. They were kind of like the rich men that didn't really care about. I don't think they were really committed as much.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't like the sheriff did. That beat CB that day. I always remember CB coming out, and I was hunting for some of the people that were going to be in the demonstration the next day wanted some red poster paper.
Mm-hmm.
So I was sent to get red. This is kind of thing, you know, that I would do.
Mm-hmm.
They'd be afraid to go downtown. And anyway, they were having a boycott. And so I'd go down and find some red post paper. I was downtown hunting this red post paper, and CB came out of the sheriff's office. And I looked up there, and all I saw was red. And I thought, my gosh, he's got a red poster already. And I realized he was covered with blood.
So CB came? This is the Atlanta Police Department.
No, this was in Albany.
Albany, okay. So, how about...
But Pritchett wouldn't have done that, see?
Yeah. How about the fact that there were already blacks in the Atlanta Police Force? Didn't that make any difference at all?
There were blacks in the Savannah Police Force, but the reason it didn't make any difference was they weren't allowed to arrest the white person.
Right, right.
One time I got caught in a, it was so good it happened because it made me realize, you can't even, you don't ever know how you're going to act, in a crisis. But I was staying on the corner by the Mangum Hotel and waiting for somebody to pick me up, and there's one of the three squares there, this was him.
Mm-hmm.
And I was staying there, and cat kind of crosses was Morrison's that hadn't desegregated, and I think this was after some of the major places had desegregated, because some of the even places did, and after the threat of the fire. And so they'd been picketing at Morrison's. And so something happened over there. And what had happened was a white man knocked down a black picket, and then another one kicked him. And the black policeman came, and they couldn't arrest the white man. It didn't. They could stand by him and call somebody else, but they couldn't arrest him.
This was where?
In Savannah.
Savannah.
And so they were calling for someone else. And in the meantime, the crowd gathered like they came out of the rocks. I don't know where that crowd came. It hadn't been there before. It'd been a little knees with ticket before. All of a sudden, there was a crowd. All of a sudden, there was a crowd of whites.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I don't ever remember deciding to move from where I was. The next time I came to my senses, the thing was over. I had gone to the black side, and the fire engine had come and sprayed water in the middle to separate the...
Mm-hmm.
And it had separated with the fire hose. Not hurting, but it wasn't a fire hose thing like
Birmingham.
But it's a good way to stop a mob. It was just a mob, just rolling this one like that. And they did it so quickly that nobody was ever hurt that day. And I found myself standing there in the middle of the park, not knowing how I'd gotten there, what, just like I'd been unconscious almost. It is strange, that mob feeling that you could get caught up in. It's good to have, to know that I can, you think you have done some film.
Yeah, I would, yeah. Did you ever get any feeling about Ivan Allen in terms of his,
Yeah, well, I always thought Ivan Allen was good,
yeah.
But I never did have any personal experience with him.
Yeah. How about the importance of racial factors in any decision making in the places you work, city or state? I have a quote from Maynard Jackson, 1975, in which he said, "Race is the underlying force in the area's politics, no matter what the rhetoric." How much was race the subtle, the underlying factor in a lot of cases that you could see?
I'd say 9/10 of the cases.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, I'm afraid it still is. I think it's not that. I think in a way, maybe it wasn't, and maybe it just seemed that way because everything was so much more blatant. But it seemed to me it was simpler then. It was just everything was raised practically, and you do anything rather than have like a lady said to me one time, she said, "I'm not like a lot of people." I said, "How do you think that niggers are human?" I think she was still saying niggers. No, she was probably saying nigger, because that was what I think a lot of people say, that the niggers are human. But I remember having my mind just blown. I didn't realize it was anybody that existed. They didn't think that black people were human. I mean, it's never had dawned on me that people could feel like. Then she went on to explain it. So I think, well, I guess they had to protect themselves from the way they treated people. I don't know. But racism, I think it's very simple today, because I think that there are a lot of different elements that probably in just as strong as racism, as it's a class. Because I felt like like that 1970, remember feeling that class was going to be our problem next, more than our being having worked mostly as a volunteer, although that was a paid job. And I worked 5 years with the government and civil rights, well, that was okay. But aside from those 15 years, why I've always just been a volunteer. And if you're a volunteer, you always want to be working what you felt like was important.
Of course.
And I remember in 1954 deciding this education is going to be the most important issue.
Do you think a lot of the public political decisions during that time were basically race-related decisions? Schooling, healthcare, recreation, development of the highway system. Do you think a lot of those had?
Well, just for instance, they passed the. We never had very much, take schools, we never had much state money for schools. And so all of a sudden then they passed the, I heard the QBE so much now, I can't remember what that was called. Minimum something standards. I forget what it was called, but it had a little slogan. And it was the first time that a lot of state money went in.
Public
school. So what year is it? It was about 52. I'm guessing that. And I don't remember who was there, but it was wonderful because for the first time, lots of places to go are going to have 9 months school. And a lot of whites versus blacks didn't have because it was still the remnant of the old plantation days when the rich went to private schools and the poor didn't get educated. And it didn't matter, and particularly mill owners. And the mill owners wanted to keep whites then, and they didn't work blacks in the mills. They only worked whites, and believe you me, they weren't going to see them educated one inch.
So what?
Pay it or anything.
Why 1952? This was anticipation.
They saw the coming of the desegregation. I think that entered into all of that. And so then immediately after 53, and I probably count the time you just had their hands in this a lot. Because then you see what they started to do was building black schools. They built black schools like crazy.
Upgrading the other ones that were already there? Also.
So the black schools that were there were not, they were in, they made the blacks produce a building and then maybe they'd give them some teaching.
Mm-hmm.
Was the way they ran the schooling for black people.
But they began to build a lot of schools.
So they built new schools, everything.
And what was this to keep the blacks from going to the white schools?
Yeah, and it did. I mean, after all, when school desegregation came, there were a lot of blacks that didn't want it.
Yeah. Didn't want this school desegregation?
Didn't want, and particularly the leadership, because the teachers and principals did not want it. That was about the highest paying job you could get. They didn't want desegregation. They knew they wouldn't be treated better than they were.
I'm sure some of the principals lost their jobs too.
Did they ever more? Yeah. I remember one that was one of the best principals I ever saw in my life. Her name was, gosh, I forget what. She was up in North Georgia, and she had graduated from some northern university, and almost every kid in her school, black kid in her school, went to college. But this was in a smaller area where there was many blacks, and the blacks had a little more chance than it was in the north. Up around the North Calhoun area.
Well, this was happening in Atlanta too, the building of new schools. So this was all, I've heard this expression before, Supreme Court schools, that they were built to keep blacks from being interested in going to white schools.
Right.
Okay. Are you familiar at all, very much with the desegregation in Atlanta during this time?
Yes, because we organized Hope.
Oh, right, that's right, yeah.
Although in Hope again, I worked on a statewide organization there. Because I already had experience. Well, I was state president of even those in a very crucial and wonderful time. At the time that we had. The biggest political fights, and that was over county unit system and over open school. And I was president at that time. And so I worked real hard with that. And we'd organized innumerable new leagues all over the state because, as some people might tell you who are segregationist inclined, that the league stand on segregation made us lose members. We did. We lost some members. I remember one, we lost Maury Flowers in Thomasville. And that I think that league even folded because she was pouring money into it like nothing else. But she was real segregationist. And so it's true. Some of the real segregationists did drop out.
Mm-hmm.
But for everyone that dropped out, we had 10 that joined because a lot of people wanted things to happen and they believed in public schools.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And they didn't want to see public schools go. And public schools had been a fight in Georgia because it hadn't been popular with a lot of people. At one period, the mill owners had too much power in the state. And they didn't want public education. They didn't want the mill hands to get any money.
Mm-hmm.
So public education is something that I wish that some more people were working on now. Anyway, what
were we starting to say about? Well, I'm curious about really is how we move from
Oh, so in Atlanta, yes. So then we organized Hope.
Right.
But I was just giving that as a background, the reason that I was kind of assigned. At first, I wasn't going to Hope,
yeah,
because Hope was all white. And I decided in 1954, at the time of the Supreme Court decision, that I would not be associated with any group, socially or otherwise, that was all white. I mean, the profession would be all white.
Right.
I don't mean it. I wouldn't go into it all white.
I understand.
But you know, church, club, or what? And so, but that was the personal decision that I made. So Hope was all white.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had talked with the people that were organized, and we had talked about how we could organize this and that. But I said, well, if it's all white, I'm not going to do it. And so then two or three blacks, one of them, Don Hollowell, talked to me,
mm-hmm,
and said, now look, Francis, we think that the Hope will be more effective if it's all white. Please go on and work with them. Well, if the blacks asked me to go on and work with them, I did. So I threw in my towel. And Mira Loki can tell you more about Hope if you haven't talked with her. So we worked terribly hard, and I worked terribly hard in Hope. And then out of Hope came what? SOS, Save Our Schools, and all the other things that came out that helped with desegregation of schools in Atlanta. So I was closely connected with it, and by that time then I went into the council job, and we used a lot of the same techniques and same materials that we had used. We used in our work in desegregating schools, and we worked with friends, service committee, and other people in CP and other places throughout the state.
I guess one of the things I was curious about is how we moved from beginning desegregation in 1961 to within a 10-year period total resegregation of the Atlanta schools. You know, what went wrong? Was it Superintendent Lutzen? Could he move faster?
I think the biggest tragedy of all was that we lost the Metro suit. Now, when we put in the Metro suit,
mm-hmm,
if we could have won that...
I mean, this is cross-county?
Yes. I don't think we had a chance of keeping Atlanta segregated if the schools stayed in separate districts.
Mm-hmm.
Blacks was flocking to Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, a lot of the schools were getting inferior. I sit and look at I have a daughter that teaches in an all-black school in Mobile, Alabama, and I sat and looked at that class, see the quality of work that those children did, and I wouldn't let my white child stay there.
So do you think the black schools, let's say in a place like Atlanta, did get inferior?
Yeah.
And what happened though? I mean, did the school board...
For instance, Girls High School, when I went to Agnes Scott when I graduated in 1927, why the best prepared girls that came to Agnes Scott came from Girls High School in America. The schools did go down.
Well, I'm definitely curious about what happened. Did the school board give less money to the black schools?
There's no money packed at the black schools. The black schools got the old books. They didn't even give a new book. The quality of the education was so far below. I didn't work in the black schools in Atlanta,
right,
but I worked in the black schools in Decatur. I always lived in Decatur. But I worked at the black schools in Decatur.
But I mean, after desegregation, supposedly the schools are being integrated, so...
It's supposedly, yes, but in fact, no. I mean, the school board wasn't going. They weren't going to buy a whole ton of new books and give them to the black schools.
So even after integration, the black schools are still being treated as second class.
Well, they still are now. It's been proven in the DeKalb case. But the Metro case, if we could have won it, might have saved Atlanta. And I think it's terribly bad for schools to be economically segregated as much as it is racially segregated. But when you get in a school, like the one where my daughter teaches, where every child is eligible for free lunch, and rarely there's a child in the school that has two parents. I'm telling you, you've got a rough road there.
Sure do.
As far as those kids having any chance, because they're not going to learn from their peers.
No, I think the peer pressure would be the other way.
The peer pressure is going to be the other way. Yeah. Now the strange thing about it is, in her school, and a lot of the schools in Mobile, they haven't gotten the drugs into them like we have in our schools in Atlanta.
Just getting back to the Atlantic school, do you think something like the Freedom of Choice Plan that was tried earlier, the Board of Education made it easy or difficult for black students to transfer?
They made it terribly difficult. You had to go through all those tests, a million tests. They had to go for time.
What do you think the thrust was? The thrust was to make it difficult to integrate and to make an attempt to build more black schools so the blacks would be happy where they were.
And they had a lot of people on their side because they had a lot of black leadership on their side to do it, black school leadership.
Right.
But now, what was that one? Was Jean Fairfax with the Friends Service Committee?
Mm-hmm.
And she worked on student segregation down here. We worked together with her a lot. And then after that, she worked legal defense for them in New York. She was positive that given the chance, the black kids would flock to a better school.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
She was positive. I wasn't. Well, I suppose she was a well-educated, professional black person, and my association with blacks until 1954 had been nothing except cook in the yard. And I had heard my cook say too many times, I don't understand why these people are fussing about the schools. Our kids got a school.
How good a school is the question?
And she didn't understand it.
Yeah.
She could write a little bit, but her husband couldn't read and write. If they had a school to go to, that was great. And I remember Jean Fairfax so well, how disappointed she was and how sick at heart she was, because she would just spend lots of time down here in town after town just trying to persuade some people to go to white school.
You don't think the black kids wanted to go to the white school?
They didn't want to go to white school. Well, sometimes parents wanted to because they thought they'd get a better education.
Right.
And but a lot of times then the kids wouldn't want to go. Sometimes the kids would want to go and the parents wouldn't want to go.
So basically what they wanted was an upgrading in black schools.
Yes, that was only the kind of the elite people that wanted that. It was the common people didn't realize what they didn't have.
But the black schools themselves weren't that upgraded anyway. I caught a few cases, for example, where there could have been an effort to maintain a transitional neighborhood as an integrated one. For example, the Cascade Heights area at one point was maintaining its white population as the blacks came in, and the school there, the high school there also. But my general thinking was that the school was allowed to deteriorate slowly. The Board of Education did not want to support an integrated school and allowed it to
exactly drop. And so much just depending, everything depended on the school board.
Right.
Well, the whole quality of the integration did, and I learned that so much because I was coordinator from Mississippi for several years when I worked with the government and student segregation. And if you found a superintendent and a school board that was willing to integrate is okay. Because then they would listen. They would listen to you saying, this works here, that works there. See what kind of a plan you can work out will be the best. You can try pairing. You can try this. You can try that. You know, all the different ways. And sit down, they would talk and figure, and we would sit and talk and figure and burn the midnight all over it. And then, now how can we do it smoothly? Well, the best way to do is get the football coach on your side, get the football team on your side, and have them come in and give them some training. And then have the black kids that are coming come for a preview and learn where the John is and all that, and have the football, white football boys take them and show them where, you know, and all this kind of stuff. I mean, we just had a bunch of tricks that we knew worked.
Yeah, I think that would work, right?
And so it had people that wanted to do it. You could do it, and lots of places did.
How about John Lutzen in Atlanta?
I don't know, because I never worked with John Lutzen.
Okay.
So I can't say that. I think it's better to talk to somebody who worked with him.
Yeah, okay.
I'd rather talk about things I know.
Of course.
I think that means more to you.
Do you think the, of course, yeah. Do you think the tremendous effort by the school boards to fight integration had an effect on the quality of everybody's school?
For
the money and the time going into fighting this?
It used to worry me, and I think that was certainly brought out by Bob Cole in his book. It used to worry me what happened to the white kids. I remember one story of they integrated the buses, and the kids were standing waiting for the bus, and the white mama was worried about her little boy and catching the integrated bus, and the black mama was worried about her little boy. To the office, because she said the little girl is talking terribly to me, and she said, she called me a white son of a bitch, and went on to say that I can't remember all that she had said. I'm sure the little girl knew plenty of words to use, and if she was like the kids I worked with, and this principal said to the teacher. But she said, what had you said to her that made her angry? And she said, I told her, you little black nigger, sit down in that seat and shut up your mouth. And the principal said to the teacher, well, suppose after this, you call your students by their name.
What was this now?
And that was in South Georgia. That was nice, wasn't it? So there's some nice stories that came out of it. A lot of nice stories.
But basically, you think that the plan to start at the high school level and integrate was done to...
I think it was done just to make it difficult. I think everything was done.
Yeah, you think the whole process was to slow it down as much as possible.
And we never could have got anywhere without court, because it was all court cases.
Right. So in other words, by the time the blacks were able to gain some control over the school system, at least in Atlanta, there was hardly any whites around.
That's right.
Yeah.
There were a few whites that stuck with it, like Betsy Stone, and she'd be a good one to talk to.
Who's she?
She's head of Apple now. And she lives out in West Whitney Road, and she kept her kids in white schools. And in fact, I think her little boy, her youngest one, who is still in high school now, he's at Northside, but right now he's in Israel office. He's in Tel Aviv. But somebody asked him when he was being, they were giving him some orientation about on this trip. He said, well, how do you think you can manage, can you manage being in the minority? Because you're going to be American and you're not Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, I've always been in the minority ever since I started school.
Good background for him then.
Yeah,
do you think whites were affected in other ways? I mean, the impact, one of the things I'm looking at is the impact of segregationist practices on healthcare, crime, housing. And I was curious what did whites as well as blacks lose from the segregated system? How were whites affected by all this? It was clear how blacks were affected.
Whites were affected just as bad because it is just as great a disservice to your child to teach them that they're superior as it is to teach them that they're inferior.
Okay, but how about in things like health care? I mean, blacks were losing out. They were not getting the health care they deserved.
Right.
Were whites also suffering in terms of what was denied blacks with this whole segregated system, housing, crime?
Well, certainly, I'm thinking of early days in healthcare when it was so poor in this county, and the poor whites. Well, I helped to found a clinic, in fact, in the 30s,
mm-hmm.
and because it upset me so bad because so many people were so poor,
mm-hmm.
and I had two babies. And we didn't have any money, but we had enough money that we never were hungry. Because
mm-hmm.
my husband was a professional man, a landscape architect, and you can imagine that that work was zero on depression. And so, but we had all the real things.
Well, we should be finishing it.
That's all right.
I was saying,
but we established a clinic and we didn't desegregate it.
Uh-huh.
And this was way back, let's see, in the 30s or early 40s. And so they all came to clinic. Now some things were already segregated that we had in this clinic were already segregated. For instance, they had black venereal day and white venereal day when they had the syphilis. See, that was before they had all the fancy drugs. So some things were desegregated by in the way the clinics were set up. And we had black dentists and black people with the black dentists and white people with white dentists. But then the regular medical clinic was all desegregated.
Mm-hmm.
And the grand jury came over and said we were breaking the law, but we had segregation. So only idea anybody had was to take care of sick people.
And this was in Atlanta?
This was in DeKalb County.
Okay. It seems to me the dual school system, dual hospital care,
yeah.
I mean, that all had to affect whites, too. But
yeah.
It couldn't have been as much money just to go
and
around.
You see, in Atlanta, the black gravy was better than the white gravy.
Really?
Because black gravy was under Emory,
right.
And was their teaching unit.
Right.
And one of the reasons that they put that thing together was because the black was better than the white.
Put what thing together?
Put integrated that gravy.
Well, it took them a long time to do it. It wasn't until the 60s, really, that...
They got integrated, but that's why they did it then.
I thought they did it also because some black doctors could visit their patients, but black patients in Grady, which they weren't allowed to do before.
Well, yeah, we had some other little byproducts in it, too, but the main underlying thing was Emory had the black side and didn't have the white side, and the black side was better than the white side as far as the medical care. But all of the building and all of the facilities were worse.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and also Emory was expanding and they needed more patients too.
So the black hospital parking was worse, but the medical care was better.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah, very funny. One last thing. Obviously, working in very controversial areas during this time, was there any retaliation against those working in your organization? People fired from the jobs, harassed in any way? Did you get that at all?
Oh.
What ways?
Oh, yeah, you just got threats all the time.
Threats. Anybody dismissed from positions, not fired?
I don't remember, but I remember as a minister coming to see, my husband was Episcopalian. Mm-hmm. This wasn't the Episcopal minister in his church, but the Episcopal minister in another church came into our house, sat down in our living room, told my husband he should stop me from what I was doing. Mm-hmm. My husband was so sweet. Very sweet person. He talked to me for 6 months. He never got mad at him. He never said anything ugly to him. They had this whole conversation. And then the man left and built life. And probably Bill didn't get a job or two, maybe here and there. But he did get a few jobs because I did do it. But I did do some of the things that I did. But he was a great person because he thought I could do what I thought I should do. He gave me complete support. But I had they were organized. I had bomb threats. I never had a person put a bomb on the woman's. And you name it, you had it. Everybody did get worked in it, but it got to be a kind of a way of life.
Yeah.
You just couldn't. I never did go as far as some of them did. They were much greater than I. And I was always thinking about I don't think I ever stopped doing something because I was scared. I didn't want to go to jail because I knew it would upset my husband. My father was still alive and lived with us, and I knew they would be so upset if I went to jail. I didn't want to go to jail, so I always avoided jail.
Mm-hmm.
Where a lot of people try, I don't mean they try to go to jail, but when they gloried in the, like John Lewis glories in the number of times he went to jail. But jail, not bail, was tried in Albany, Georgia. It didn't work. In this country, I just don't think jail, not bail, is ever going to work. It might have worked in India, but not here.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as me personally is concerned, I didn't care about that. But yeah, people lost their job. Preachers got put out of the churches.
Whites as well as blacks, right? Well, not
just whites.
No. Whites, whites lost their job, yeah.
I know a black family who put their kids in a white school, and the wife, the mother and the father lost their jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And the father never did come back home again. He left home then, and she went on welfare. And, that's one family I know, and I have followed. I've kept friends with them from then on to now. I still hear from them. And they have children and grandchildren. So, and they say they're going to kill that father. He was the first one to go back to graduate in his class. And I said, that was done. Do you think? And he said he was very clear. We're not going to have him back now. But we got the FBI and everything, and he was shining the sun, and he graduated. They made him march last in the line, and they sat him next to him to see the graduation. I mean, I know because I was there.
Amazing. Struck me tense times, I'd say, yeah.
I sat with the family. See, a lot of things you wouldn't think anything about would take a lot of courage. For instance, I remember I sat with Dr. Nishbaum when Judy was being tried in the house. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Wright in there. See, a long time Dr. Wright was sitting there in the gallery.
Yeah,
I've
heard that, yeah.
Yeah. We had a big fight over there, sitting there.
Well,